All right, so for the third week in a row, I'd like to try to finish up the section on investing. I believe I thought I'd get this far 2 or 3 weeks ago. So I do think I really can finish it this time and maybe even get into the next section. Before I get into that, I do want to express the fact that I am pleased that some of you have told me that you have increased the contributions to your 401ks. So that's good. That warms my heart when people listen to what I have to say and then do it. So I'm very thankful for that. So in this section on investing, we have looked at different types of investments and strategies. We looked at the different retirement accounts, 401ks, IRAs. We looked at using brokerage accounts as well. And then within those accounts, we looked at investing in the stock market through using mutual funds or ETFs or other such instruments like that. Then we looked at investing in gold, and we looked at investing in real estate. And now I want to do one more type of investment that I have added in this week. I hadn't intended to put this in the outline, and then I thought, well, it is so popular these days, I should address it, and that is crypto. So I want to talk about crypto, and then I want to talk about financial advisors, finishing up this section on investing, and then hopefully get into budgeting yet today. So we'll see if I can get that far. So show of hands, who knows what crypto is? Okay, so a few people kind of, some people know, some people kind of know. So crypto is short for cryptocurrencies. You've probably heard of Bitcoin. I imagine everybody, just about everybody on the planet's heard of Bitcoin at this point. That's the largest and oldest cryptocurrency. And there are many, many other ones, Ethereum, XRP, and then literally thousands of other ones. There are thousands and thousands of cryptocurrencies out there that Bitcoin enthusiasts refer to a derogatory type of coin, which rhymes with it. So anyway, that's just inside baseball stuff. There's a lot of the true believers out there are very, they're as divided on crypto as they are in like religion and Catholic versus Protestant or whatever. It's a world in of itself. But crypto has become very popular over the last decade or so. And like I said, Bitcoin was the first cryptocurrency. It was originally created in 2009. And at that point, nobody had ever heard of it except for Satoshi, the guy that supposedly created it, which who knows if that's not just a some kind of a code name for the CIA or something. I don't know. Who knows who actually created it? Nobody actually knows this guy, this Satoshi guy. Nobody knows who he is, which is kind of strange. But anyway, back in 2009, you know, nobody had heard of it before, but it was intended to be a digital currency. It was going to be outside the banking system. It was going to be anonymous, unregulated, and uninflatable. And it's still uninflatable. For the rest of that stuff, not so much anymore. But it was supposed to sort of mimic how gold works, where there's a limited amount of it. So there's only 21 million bitcoins that will ever come into existence. The software is internally limited to that, so there can never be more than 21 million bitcoins. And they have these computers that mine, quote-unquote, bitcoins by doing these hard, complex, algorithmic problems. And as they do this, they get rewarded bitcoin for it. So these computers use up massive amounts of electricity and energy. And as they do that, they figure out these equations, and then they get little pieces of bitcoin. It's like, you know, like you'd mine for gold. You put in all this energy, you dig into the earth, you find the gold, and there's only a limited amount of gold in the earth. So as you dig out all the gold, there's less and less. The easy gold's already gone. You know, people already panned it out of the creeks and found the stuff lying, you know, on the surface. And now you got to go deeper and deeper to get the gold, and it gets more and more difficult, more expensive. That's the idea with Bitcoin. And as time goes on, it gets harder and harder to mine Bitcoin. And the same amount of work that computers have to do every so often doubles. And then so they get less and less Bitcoin eventually till it gets to 21 million and there are no more Bitcoin to be mined. They're all in existence and there will be, you know, so there's no inflation of supply. The supply of Bitcoin will never go up. So of course the believers in Bitcoin believe that this is like the perfect money. It's uninflatable and it's going to be the thing of the future. It started out in the early days as pretty much a libertarian thing. Like, the only people that ever heard of Bitcoin, that ever used Bitcoin, were libertarians. Like, back when I first heard about it in 2013, like, nobody had ever heard of Bitcoin before. And it was super cheap back then. If I wouldn't have been listening to Peter Schiff, I'd have probably bought some, and I'd have a fortune right now. But I was listening to Schiff again, and Schiff's always been against Bitcoin. And he's probably right in the long term, you know. But $100,000 ago, he was definitely wrong. Because it started out as a dollar, it's at $100,000 right now. So, or it started out lower than a dollar, but anyway. So it was sold as a currency that would replace the dollar. Either, I mean, some people think it will actually replace the dollar as like the world's reserve currency. But in a minimum, it would replace the dollar for you individually. So you, instead of using dollars to buy things, you'd use bitcoins. And back in the day, I don't know if they still do it or not, but when this thing was starting to take off and Bitcoin was still usable and cheap enough to use, there were companies that were getting set up so that you could go to a coffee shop and hold out your phone, scan your QR code, and transfer Bitcoin from you to them, and that's how you'd pay. And that was the idea. And it was totally anonymous. You know, you could send money to somebody. Nobody would know who did it. You know, it's not tied to your name or any. It wasn't tied to your name. You just had these secret keys and all that stuff. And that was the idea, anyway. And you'd use it for everyday transactions, just like you'd use regular money. Well, eventually, it became too slow and expensive to be used for small transactions. Because how it worked, I don't need to get into too much of the weeds, but it works on what's called a blockchain. And this blockchain has a ledger. And this ledger contains every transaction that has ever happened in the history of Bitcoin. So billions, at this point, probably billions of transactions. Every time somebody buys or sells a Bitcoin, exchanges a Bitcoin for anything, that is added to the ledger. And that whole ledger is downloaded every single time every transaction is made. So the ledger got enormous, and it took a long time. It was no longer instantaneous. And then some computers out there have to be doing all the work to do this, and so then it got very expensive every transaction. So a long time ago, I haven't followed this aspect of it, but it was like $40 a transaction. Well, I don't know about you, but I'm not buying a dollar, you know, a $2 cup of coffee and spending $42 for it. I don't think anybody else would either, right? So eventually, the idea of it actually being a currency and actually having use value to be able to buy things with it pretty much went out the window. And then they sold it as digital gold. So they'd say, well, you know, gold, you buy gold. You don't buy gold to actually do transactions. You don't buy things with an ounce of gold. It's too expensive. You know, you just buy gold to preserve your purchasing power, to preserve value. And then you know, if you want to trade it back in for currency someday to buy something big, you can do that. So it was sold as digital gold. It was going to be a store of value. And then eventually, as time went on, it went from being this niche libertarian thing that, you know, only people that are concerned about privacy were into, until every Tom, Dick, and Harry got interested in it. And then by that point, so did the SEC get interested in it, the Securities and Exchange Commission, and now they regulate it. Now it's just like any other asset. You pay capital gains on it. I don't know if you ever paid attention when you've been filling out your taxes the last couple of years. Question right on there. Have you bought any cryptocurrency, bought or sold or traded any cryptocurrency? So, you know, there's the IRS taxes. It's just like any other asset. It all of a sudden isn't what it was, you know, originally built to be. And it's basically nothing. Like, it's literally nothing. It's digits. It's digits out in the ether. It's nothing. It is nothing. It's backed by nothing. It's used for nothing. And it's only gone up in price because people buy it expecting it to go up in price. That's it. The only reason anybody buys Bitcoin today is because they think it's going to go up in price. That's the only, there's no purpose. There's no other purpose to own Bitcoin except that it's going to go up in price, right? Remember like the housing bubble days, you know, where you just buy a house with an ARM, with an interest only adjustable rate mortgage or whatever, and you got nothing to worry about because your house is just always going to go up in value. It's just going to go up in value. It's going to go up. So everybody bought houses because it's going to go up in value forever, right? Like that mania. You know what that's called? It's called a bubble, right? This is what Bitcoin is, I think. The only reason people buy it is because it's going to go up in value. Now, you could say, well, that's the same with stocks. Well, not exactly, because when you buy stock in a company, you actually own a piece of that company. So if you buy stock in Apple, you own a little piece of their factories, you own a little piece of all the real estate that they have, you own a little piece of all of their production, you own a little piece of everything they do, all their intellectual property. Like, you are a part owner of that productive company. You actually own something. When you buy Bitcoin, you don't own anything. You only bought it so you can sell it to the next sucker. And once you run out of suckers, then the price is going to fall. And over time, it's been adopted by more and more people. And eventually, it got to where institutions started adopting it. And now you can even buy an ETF, which you can just buy Bitcoin in your stockbroker account, just like you buy stocks. I'm not going to get into all that. But anyway, like literally anybody can buy Bitcoin without actually owning Bitcoin now. You don't have to have the wallets and digital wallets and all that stuff. So when I first heard about it, like I said, in 2013, it was under $100, and I've been watching it ever since. I never bought any of it. I wish I did. I wish I'd have bought it a long time ago. I mean, heck, if you put $1,000 in Bitcoin back when I first heard about it, you'd have $1 million. You put $10,000, you'd have $10 million, right? I mean, you could make huge, huge money back in the day. Of course, you know, hindsight's always 20/20. Price peaked out in January 2025. So far, anyway, at almost $110,000 per Bitcoin. It fell to $82,000 in April, just last month, and now it's at about $94,000 as of the end of April. Now, Bitcoin and crypto in general is an extremely volatile asset. If you look at the price chart of Bitcoin and you start calculating the percentage swings, it is crazy volatile. Like, you know, the stock market is volatile. I told you the gold mining sector is very volatile. Well, Bitcoin is that on steroids times 50. I mean, Bitcoin is extremely volatile. And yeah, I mean, you could make huge money. If you'd have bought it just a year or so ago, you'd have made enormous money. But, you know, who knows? If you'd have bought it a little before that, you'd have lost, and then, you know, had to sell, you'd have lost huge money. So it's very volatile. So I recommend not investing in Bitcoin or any crypto unless you are investing money that you are fine with losing. And that's okay. You know, it's okay to take some of your money, if you have some, that you're just say, you know what, this is money. If it's gone, I don't care. If I put this $1,000 in Bitcoin and it goes to zero tomorrow, I don't care. It doesn't matter. $1,000 will not change my life one iota. If that's you, and you want to put $1,000 in Bitcoin, go ahead, you know, or some other cryptocurrency, go ahead. But just know you could easily lose. I did buy some XRP recently, which I'd never bought any crypto before, and I had an old friend who I used to work with, and we have reconnected, and he just kept hounding me about XRP. Dude, you got to get XRP. You got to get XRP. It's the crypto that this Ripple technology runs on, and Ripple's the wave of the future. Ripple, all these huge banks have deals with Ripple, and they're going to be, this is what they're going to use for bank-to-bank transactions, and maybe they will. And so he just kept getting on me, so I bought some XRP. And if it goes to zero, no big deal. If it goes where he says it's going to go, I'd have a small fortune, right? Because he says it's going to go like way, way, way up, you know. Now, who knows? Who knows? It probably won't. It'll probably go nowhere. But I'm okay with that because, you know, I didn't invest my life savings in it or anything, you know, so it's not a big deal. But nobody knows what Bitcoin or other cryptos will do in the future. So you'd be very cautious in investing any serious money into it. Like I said, if you've got money that you don't care about, then, you know, fine. But don't put any serious money into it. Do not take out a HELOC, a second mortgage on your house, and invest in Bitcoin. Now you laugh and you think, who would do that? I've got a very close friend of mine that did it. You don't know him. But yeah, he took out a second mortgage on his house and invested in Bitcoin. Now, if he would sell right now, he did very, very well on that. But he thinks it's going to go higher, and he's got a certain point he wants to sell at. Well, you never know. He might end up losing a lot of that. So not a good idea. If I were my friend, I would sell the portion of my Bitcoin to pay off the second mortgage And then if you want to leave the rest of it in Bitcoin and see what happens, fine and dandy. That way you haven't lost anything. But never borrow money for an investment, period. Never borrow any kind of money of any sort for any investment, no matter how safe and secure and guaranteed it is. Never, ever do that. The market can stay insolvent, or the market can stay irrational longer than you can stay solvent, as John Maynard Keynes said. One of the only good things he ever said. And another thing, never use money that you're going to need in the near term, and you know you're going to need it, to invest with. For instance, I had a church member one time that cashed out part of his 401k to pay off a bunch of debt. And when you do that, you have to pay, if it's a traditional, you got to pay all the taxes on it and the penalty. So if you cash out, you know, 50 grand, well, a big chunk of that is like 30% of it, you got to set aside to pay taxes at the end of the year. And so he says, hey, I'm thinking about and taking this money that I have set aside to pay for the taxes and investing it in Bitcoin, because then, you know, it could like double my money. I'd pay the taxes and I'd have all that money back or whatever. And I'm like, no, absolutely do not do that. That is the worst idea ever. Do not do that. Thankfully, he listened to me. Sadly, if he wouldn't have listened to me, he would have done well, because Bitcoin went on a big tear after that. But I stand by my advice. I don't care if Bitcoin went to 10 billion. I stand by my advice. Never invest money that you owe the IRS in Bitcoin to hope to flip it within the year. That's insane. That is insane. So if you invest in Bitcoin or crypto, and you invest like real money, a lot of your net worth in it, you could get rich and you could go broke. Either one, depending on what happens. And remember what Proverbs 13:11 says. Wealth gotten by vanity shall be diminished, but he that gathereth by labor shall increase. If you think, I'm going to buy this crypto, it's the new upcoming Bitcoin, and I am so certain of it. I watched this YouTube video. I listened to this guy. I don't know even who he is, but he's some guy, and he's got a nice background on his video, and he sounds smart, and he knows what he's talking about. And he told me this crypto is going to go up by 10,000% next year. It's a guaranteed thing. Therefore, I'm going to take out everything I have in my retirement 401k. I'm going to put it all in this, because then I'm going to be rich. You're going to be broke. You're going to be poor. Don't do it. Don't put serious money into it, because you could end up broke. And that's all I'll say about that. Now, let's talk about financial advisors. It is wise to seek counsel when making important decisions. And this would go for any kind of decision. Let's turn to Proverbs in chapter 20. I do have a few verses here. Proverbs actually has a lot to say about this. It's wise to seek counsel. This used to be one of my soapboxes. Over the years, I've noticed that I had soapboxes, and I would get on a soapbox for a few years, and I'd get on another soapbox. I was on this soapbox for a long time, and then I just got tired of it. And then I just thought, whatever, do whatever you want. You want to get counsel, get it. You want to make dumb decisions, do that too, whatever. So I don't really harp on this one anymore. I assume I've done it enough. But Proverbs 20 and verse 18 says, every purpose is established by counsel, and with good advice make war. So your purpose will be established, made firm or stable. You're going to be on good, solid ground if you get counsel. Especially if it's something serious like going to war, right? And that doesn't have to be with another country. It could be with your neighbor or your spouse or your employer, or, you know, it could be you could go to war with a lot of different people. It's always good to get counsel before you do that. Proverbs 24 and verse 6. For by wise counsel thou shalt make thy war, and in the multitude of counselors there is safety. So it's safe to get multiple counsel, to go to multiple people for counsel. And the bigger the issue, the bigger the problem is, the bigger the thing is, the more counsel you should get. If you're making major life decisions with no counsel, you're a fool. Or if I talk to my buddy or whatever, I talk to whoever I knew was going to tell me whatever I'm doing is a great idea, you're a fool, right? Go to people that are going to tell you it's a bad idea and hear why they say it's a bad idea, and then, you know, get a well-rounded series of counsel. and then make your decision after that. This is what wise people do. Wise people will seek out wise counsel. Proverbs 1 and verse 5. Because, you know, it says that the counsel of man is like deep waters, and a man of understanding shall draw it out of him. Wise men aren't going to come up knocking on your door and say, hey, here's what I think you should do. They're not going to do that. If you want to get counsel from a wise man, you go to him. He's not going to come to you. He's smart enough to know that unsolicited advice is useless. Proverbs 1 and verse 5. A wise man will hear and will increase learning, and a man of understanding shall attain unto wise counsels. See, it's not stupid people that go for counsel. It's a man of understanding. A smart person goes for counsel. A smart person goes and gets advice. That's not for stupid people. It's for smart people. Most people think, well, if you're smart, you don't need to get advice. The Bible says if you're smart, you'll go get advice. That's what smart people do. Dumb people do whatever they feel like, whatever feels good, whatever they want to. And they don't get advice. Because dumb people are smart enough to realize that if they go get advice from somebody, that person's going to tell them, don't do the dumb thing, and I really want to do the dumb thing, so I'm not going to get advice. That's what happens. That's called that old self-deception thing. Proverbs 18 and verse 15. Proverbs 18, 15. The heart of the prudent getteth knowledge, and the ear of the wise seeketh knowledge. Again, a wise person seeks knowledge. That means a wise person knows that he doesn't know it all. He knows that there's more knowledge to get, and he goes after it. Right? It's not the dumb person that needs knowledge, it's the smart person. Well, the dumb person needs it too, but he's too dumb to go looking for it. Like I said a minute ago, people who make important decisions without wise counsel are headed for trouble. Proverbs 11 and verse 14. And this definitely applies in the financial sphere. Proverbs 11, 14. Where no counsel is, the people fall. But in the multitude of counselors, there is safety. No counsel, you're going to fall. And no counsel, your net worth is going to fall too. You go out and invest in crazy, stupid things because you get big dollar signs in your eyes and think that this is the thing, and you go out without counsel, get ready for your investment portfolio to fall too. The more important the decision is, the more important it is to get multiple opinions. Again, we've already read several verses that have said this, and this just shows you the importance of it because the Bible just keeps repeating it. Proverbs 15:22. Proverbs 15:22, without counsel, purposes are disappointed, but in the multitude of counselors, they are established. So if you have an important life-changing decision to make, like some major life thing, and you don't get any counsel, you're foolish. As a matter of fact, if you don't go to at least two or three people for counsel, you are foolish on a major life event, life-changing thing. That's what the scripture says. Now, this is important in investing and wealth management. And I always try to practice what I preach with you. And that's one thing that's, either you could say, a blessing or a burden of being a preacher. If you're going to be a preacher with integrity, you preach to people the scripture, you preach to them what they should do, and then if you're a man of integrity, you say, you know what, I have to do it too. And then now I'm on the hook, and now I've got to do it. Maybe I would have put it off before, but now I have to do it because I just told other people to do it. And if I don't do it myself, what am I? Right? So I've done this myself. I've had meetings with three financial advisors in the last couple of weeks, with three different companies, five different advisors, but three different companies. And the reason I'm doing this at this point in my life is because I postponed investing in retirement for a number of years for two reasons. One was a career change 12 years ago when I went into the ministry, and I no longer for a long time had really any money to put into retirement. And then secondly, whatever money I did have and was able to save, I've been saving for a house. So I postponed retirement investing for those two reasons. Once we buy a house, which we hope to do here in the not-too-distant future, then I plan to get very serious about investing for retirement and do whatever I can to make up for lost time. And so I'm not ready to do that just yet because I'm still waiting, still saving for the house, still waiting and whatever. But I wanted to talk to some financial advisors to get a game plan to know what I want to do when that time comes. So when that time comes, I can hit the ground running. And so that's what I've done. So I'm not telling you to do anything that I haven't done myself. And don't just take my word for it. Thomas J. Stanley in The Millionaire Next Door, the book that I've recommended, he said, "Your ability to hire high-grade financial advisors is directly related to your propensity to accumulate wealth." So this is his opinion based on studying hundreds and hundreds of millionaires for, you know, his career. This is basically what his career was about. And that's what he says. Your propensity to accumulate wealth is going to have to do with your ability, be proportional to your ability to hire high-grade financial advisors. Also in the book, he said, most PAWs, that's prodigious accumulators of wealth, most PAWs we have interviewed make their own investment decisions. They take the time and energy to study investment opportunities. They consult with financial advisors, but ultimately their investment decisions are their own. And I found that interesting. So the average millionaire doesn't just go to any old, just to whoever, some financial advisor and just say, hey, here's all my money. Just do something with it. You know, I'll just do an automatic, electronic transfer from my bank account every 2 weeks. And here's the money. You just do it. That's not what millionaires do. They get the advice. They weigh it out. They consider what the suggestions are. And then ultimately, they make the decision. They may let somebody else handle the nitty-gritty of it, but they're saying, this is what I'm going to invest in. This is the sector I want to invest in. This is how much. This is, you know, whatever. They're ultimately in the driver's seat. He says again in the book, choose a financial advisor who is endorsed by an enlightened accountant and or his clients with investment portfolios that in the long run outpace the market. If you don't have an accountant, hire one. So it's always a good idea to, you know, get a recommendation for a financial advisor from, like he said, like an accountant or something. And one place to start would be Ramsey Solutions, Dave Ramsey's place. He has partnerships with what he calls SmartVestor Pros, and you go in there and punch in your name and zip code and telephone number and email address, and within 30 seconds you're going to get 5 calls, which is irritating, but just forget about it. Just take one and then call the other ones back when you feel like it or whatever. But and there are people that are like-minded with Ramsey, and I mean they haven't necessarily been, he vets them to some extent, but it's not, they're not like trained by Ramsey or anything necessarily, but it's a place to start. That's where I found several of them, and was pretty impressed with a couple of them that I talked to through him. One thing I would say, if you're seeking a financial advisor, that it's important to consider that we're living in very different times now than we were 70 or 60 or 50, 40, 30, 20, 10, 5 years ago even. I mean, things are different now. I mean, some things remain the same, obviously. I mean, laws of economics haven't changed. But there is, I mean, the country is in a much different position than it was in your parents' day, financially. The country is in a lot different position. So if a financial advisor is just blindly going about things the way that his grandpa did things, you know, he might be leading you into a ditch. So you do want to consider that. So now I want to give you some ways to determine if you want to work with a financial advisor. So when you, if you are in a position where you need to, and you start interviewing some of them, I'd recommend, you know, doing that. And when you interview a few of them, this would be things to consider, and then, you know, to determine how you would go about picking one. Now, it just depends on a person's financial situation. If you're a younger person and you're an employee, and the money that you have to invest is just going in your 401k, you probably don't need a financial advisor. I mean, you might need to talk to somebody just briefly and say, hey, here are the available funds. Which ones do you recommend? What percentages should I put in them? You know, should I do the traditional 401k at work or the Roth 401k? And, you know, and he can look at what your income is, what your tax bracket is, what you think your income will be in the future, and all that kind of thing. But that would be more like a one meeting kind of thing. And you don't really, he doesn't need to manage anything, right? With your 401k, you just set it up. It automatically goes into whatever funds you pick, and that's it, right? So you wouldn't pay somebody an annual fee to manage that for you, I don't think. If anything, you might want to just meet with somebody and pay him hourly once a year or something for that. If you have more money to invest or you don't want to just do the 401k, you might just get the match and then take the rest of your money and you want to work with a professional, that would be a different story. Or a lot of people, when they hire a financial advisor, is when they either get older, closer to retirement, or they get a big inheritance and they want to know, what do I do with this money or something like that. That's typically more people that would hire a financial advisor. Or if you're not, you know, in a normal situation, you don't have an employer and a 401k and all that, you know, then it might make sense. So how do you determine who you want to work with? Because, you know, financial advisors are like anything else. There's good ones and there's bad ones, right? So your financial future could very well depend on who you work with. Things could turn out better or things could turn out horribly if you, you know, got a bad one. So the first question to ask would be, how does he treat you and interact with you? So when you meet with him, maybe over the phone first of all, or maybe in person, I think, you know, in person is good at some point, definitely. But when you talk with him, how does he treat you? How does he act? You know, is he there to help you understand your options and make informed decisions? Is that what he's there for? Or does he just talk over your head and tell you what to do? You know, because someone will do that. And if you don't know much about finance and investing, a good financial advisor will recognize that very quickly. I mean, it's going to take him like 1 second to realize, oh, this person doesn't know much about this topic at all. And if he's worth his salt, he's going to dial it back. He's not going to be using jargon and technical stuff. He's not going to be throwing out all these terms that you don't understand. He's going to break it down in very simple language. And I'm not insulting anybody, but like he's talking to a child. Because if you don't know anything about it, that's what you have to do. You got to break it down. You got to start right at the very bottom. And he has to explain his terms. And when I say this, this is what I mean. When I say this, here, this fund, this investment works kind of like this. And he'd explain it to you like you would a six-year-old or whatever. And then once you start to understand, then he can start talking to you like an adult, right? There's nothing wrong with that. Everybody's got to start somewhere. You don't come out of the womb understanding what ETFs and options and puts and calls and all that. I mean, you don't know what any of that stuff is from the womb. So if he's talking about all that kind of stuff, your eyes glaze over. And if he says, don't worry about it, I'll just take care of it, Go somewhere else. If he doesn't have the nature of a teacher and a servant, then you should probably look elsewhere. Now, it's different if you go in there and you are somewhat familiar with this stuff and you know the lingo, then, yeah, he's probably going to talk the lingo with you and he's just going to assume, you know, whatever your level of knowledge is, and that's fine. But if you don't know anything and he's talking like that, that's a bad deal. Especially because he may just be doing it just to show off how impressive he is and how much he knows, and, you know, he uses all this language you don't understand. You want to ask, do you understand what he's recommending, or if you already have a financial advisor, what investments he has put you in? So when you sit down with him and he says, well, this is what we recommend that you would do, do you understand what he's talking about? Whatever these funds are, whatever these financial instruments are, do you even understand what he's talking about? If you don't, ask more questions. If he can't explain it to you in a way that you can understand it, go somewhere else, probably. Especially if it's investments that he already has you in. Do you understand what investments you're already invested in? And if you don't, you should. You know, it's not good if you don't understand and you cannot explain to others what investments you have. If somebody comes up and says, hey, I'm thinking about investing in retirement. Where do you Who do you work with? You say, I work with so-and-so at such-and-such a place. Oh, what's he have you invested in? Oh, I don't know. He just told me to put it in this, and I just did it. Well, what is it? I don't know. Well, that's a bad idea. Bad idea. You should understand what you're invested in. If you can't explain it, you should not probably be investing in it. You should be able to understand it, at least on a basic level, and be able to explain it. And any time I've had people tell, you know, explain whatever this investment they're in is, and I'm just like, okay, if that's how it really works, get out. Like, that doesn't sound, if it sounds too good to be true, it is. You know, then that brings me to the next thing. Does a potential financial advisor promise you that he's going to put you in investments with guaranteed high rates of return and guaranteed no loss of principal? If he ever tells you that, number one, if he tells you guaranteed rates of return, forget about it. Guaranteed 12%, no doubt about it. Go somewhere else. Go somewhere else. Guaranteed 12% and guaranteed you can't lose your principal, go somewhere else. I talked to a financial advisor recently, and they have these products, and supposedly, I'm not going to get into the nitty-gritty of how they work, because I somewhat understand it, but I don't even fully understand it. But supposedly, 12% guaranteed rate of return per year and guaranteed no loss of principal. It might take up to 7 years, but every year you get 12%. If it doesn't make it the first year, then you get 24% the second year, 36% the third year. It's never going to seven. You know, it always pays out before 7 years. And all this fund has to do is go up by a certain little percentage. And then if it goes up by a little percentage, then you get paid out this thing. And I'm like, well, how does that work? How do these big banks and investment houses that are running these things, how do they make money? Well, you know, they take 90% of your money just sits in bonds just in a safe return, and then 10% of it they take it and they do something, speculate with it. And I'm like, okay, so if this thing goes up by a few percent and they only have 10% of my fund, how are they making like such a killing that they can pay me 12% on my entire investment when they're only speculating with 10% themselves? I'm like, I don't know about this. This just sounds fishy to me. So something just doesn't seem right about that to me. If it sounds too good to be true, it is. I mean, if that's really the case, why would I put a dime in anything else? If you're going to give me an investment that's going to give 12% per year and guaranteed no loss of principal, and it's always worked and it's never not paid out, so essentially you're going to give me 12% per year, period, for, you know, the entirety of my life, why would I invest in anything else? Something's wrong. Something's wrong. All right, next question. This is an important one. How much does he charge? Because, you know, these guys aren't, you know, they're not running philanthropic organizations. They're not, you know, charitable 501c3s or something. They're in it to make money, which is nothing wrong with that. But how much does he charge? You want to find out, does he charge an hourly rate for consultations? Now, that could be fine if you were in the situation I mentioned a minute ago. If you have a 401k and you just want somebody to look at it and say, hey, you know, which fund should I put it in? What percentages? You know, whatever. That kind of thing, you don't need to hire him and pay him an annual fee or something. Just meet with him, pay him for his advice, and be done with it. Or does he charge an annual fee to manage your account? And this can be fine too. This can be fine too. But you want to make sure that he doesn't charge more than 1% per year or very close to it. 1% of your whole portfolio. So if you have $100,000 in there, you pay him $1,000 a year. If you have $1 million in there, you pay him $10,000 per year. If you have $5 million, you pay him $50,000 per year, right? 1%. Now, some of them, what they'll do is most of them I've found, I mean, it's limited experience, but in the three that I've talked to, they all charge about that much. Two of them charge 1%. One of them charged 1.05%, which is pretty close. One of them charged 1% until you get to 500,000, and then he charges 0.5% after 500,000. One of them charged 1.05 until you got to like 2 million, and then it went down to like 0.9, 0.8%, something like that. the more you have. But they're all, you know, basically, especially when you're starting out, they're about 1%. If they charge you more than 1%, forget about it. They're charging too much. Now, if he charges 1% per year, you want to make sure there are no additional fees for anything. Nothing. Like, you pay him nothing. Any meetings, anytime you call him up, any trades he makes, any changes he makes, anything, everything else is covered. You pay that 1%, period. Nothing else. There's no charges for anything. No hidden fees, and so on. And you might want to ask, if he charges an annual fee, what exactly is he doing on a regular basis to manage your account? Because if they use mutual funds, he's probably doing pretty much nothing. He's going to pick those mutual funds. No, he's using his expertise to pick them. And if he's worth his salt, he's always watching and seeing how these mutual funds are doing and looking for new ones. And so he may be moving you in and out, you know, over time. But more than likely, if he's using mutual funds buy and sell at the end of the trading day. You can't buy them during the day. So for that reason, if you have money automatically drafted into your investment account, it'll just, if you have $500 a week or $500 every 2 weeks or whatever, just to use a number, and they select three mutual funds and put 33% in each one, when that $500 hits, at the end of the day, X amount goes to this one, X amount goes to this one, it automatically buys them. So he's not doing anything. It's not like he's in there buying and selling for you. Now, if he's using ETFs and individual stocks and things, then he would actually be in there and buying things for you. You can't do that automatically. But anyway, it'd just be a good question to ask him, like, what exactly would you be doing on a regular basis in my account for that money? Another question to ask is, does he charge per trade? Like, every time that he buys or sells anything in your account, what does he charge for that? And there are some companies that do this. They charge every time they make a trade for you, a buy or a sell. This is usually a ripoff, in my view. And I have my 401k, the company that I have it through, or my IRA. They do that. I don't really care for it, but that's what they do. I don't think they charge an annual fee. I should look into it. I haven't even looked at that thing for a long time. But anytime I would call the guy up and he'd buy something, make a trade, it would cost me a certain commission. It just gets taken out of your account. But what this does, though, is it incentivizes them to make trades. So if they're getting paid per trade, they're going to want to trade. Oh, you know what? We should probably sell out of this and get into this or whatever, you know, because, you know, that there can be a conflict of interest. And these guys are supposed to be fiduciaries, which means that they work with your best interest in mind. They are supposed to make decisions based on what is best for you, not themselves. And I'll give you an example of somebody not doing this. I like this guy, but I had a position in this gold company. I had bought it years ago. And it had gone way down. And then it was on its way back up. And he's like, you know, we could sell this and then like buy back into it or something like that. And I didn't call him on it because I didn't want to be a jerk. But I know exactly what he was doing. It wasn't so that he could make money, but it would be that my account would look better. Because I had a big loss on that position. And that's bringing everything down. So that makes it look like, you know, my over the last several years, I've got a loss. Well, if he could sell out of that position and buy back the same position at the lower rate now, going forward, I'm going to have a gain. But now going forward, I'm going to have a big gain before I even get back to zero. And so it's still showing a loss. So even though the account's been going up, it doesn't look good because it has this big loss, you know, from years ago. And that's what he was trying to do. I didn't call him on it. I just said, no, I'll just leave it there. I didn't want to pay the commission. And I also want to have an accurate view of, okay, what did I actually make on this thing instead of having the loss hidden and then only seeing the gain? You know, what did I make on the whole thing over time? I didn't want to do that. So that was not being a fiduciary. But, you know, sometimes they'll try shady stuff like that just to make things look better, as an example. Some popular financial planning companies, and you've heard of them, drive down the road, look on the street corners, you'll see those ones. I'm not going to mention any names. But some popular financial planning companies charge you an upfront fee for as much as 5% on every fund they buy for you. So every time you buy something, 5% off the top. And this is common among these household name dealers. 5% right off the top. This is a huge ripoff. You have to get a 5% return to break even. Any investment he buys you, you're automatically 5% down. You got to go up 5% just to make his commission back. You don't make anything until it goes up 5%. Very bad, in my view anyway, very bad idea. Big ripoff. You also want to ask, are there hidden management fees in the mutual funds themselves or other financial instruments that he's recommended to you? Because you may not be, so he charges 1% as a fiduciary. There's no other fees, but he may be buying you, a Fidelity mutual fund in U.S. large cap stocks or whatever, just as an example. Well, that Fidelity mutual fund may have like a 3% front end cost that anytime you buy this fund, they're taking 3% of your money just to manage the fund. Fidelity is not your financial advisor. The group that manages the fund, because your financial advisor is just buying funds that other companies manage typically. He's not managing the funds. He's, the mutual funds that you're in, your financial advisor is not in there and trading out stocks within the fund and all that. He's not doing any of that. That's, some bigwig on Wall Street somewhere. But those funds have charges, and that's okay. They got to make their money too, right? They're doing something. They're managing this fund and making sure that, they're putting good companies in it, taking bad ones out or whatever. But you want to see what those upfront costs are, because if he's putting you in funds and it's a 3% front end load, you're down 3% immediately every time you buy it, which is fine. If it goes up 12% per year, you're still making 9 or whatever. But, if he's got a crappy fund that's making 7% or something, minus 3, you're making 4, put your money in a high yield savings account and go home. Forget about it, right? So, you want to consider that also. Like I said, even if you're not paying these fees to your financial advisor, you may be paying them to the company who manages the fund. You don't even realize it. You never see the bill. It's, if you buy $100 of this mutual fund, they take 3 of those dollars for themselves, and the 97 buys shares of the fund. You never even know it, right? So it's just something to look at. All right, here's another question for him. Now, I know this one's going to make all of you nervous. And most of you are going to think, I would never do this. This is completely inappropriate. But I recommend doing it. And guess what? Remember what I told you when I tell you to do something? You know what I do? I do it, right? Right? Or at least I should. And this time I did. Ask a potential financial advisor what his net worth is. You might say, that's below the belt. That's wrong. Never ask somebody something like that. Why not? I'm not asking him how much money he makes. I think that's inappropriate to ask somebody. You never ask somebody how much money they make. But to ask, especially a financial advisor, what's in your, what do you have in your investment account for your retirement? What's wrong with that? I don't have a problem with it. And I would ask him, what's your net worth excluding home equity? Because he may have, a $600,000 house. And he's like, oh, I got $600,000 net worth. You're like, oh, that doesn't sound too bad. Except he doesn't have one penny to rub against another because it's all in his house, right? So ask him what his net worth is, excluding home equity. Don't be afraid to ask this question. Like I said, I'm sure most of you would be, and it might feel uncomfortable, but I think it's a great question. Now, you have to preface it. You don't just sit down and say, hey, how much money you got? Preface it. You say, and this is not the first question. This is like the last question. Say, I got one more question for you. It's a personal one. You don't have to answer it if you don't want to. But here's why I'm going to ask it. Because if I'm looking for somebody to manage my money, I want to know how he manages his own. I want to know how you've done with your own money if you're going to manage mine. And if you are using the same strategies and tactics to manage my money as your money, then presumably you ought to have done pretty well, right? If I'm going to follow your investment strategy and you've got, you don't have to tell them this, but if you've got nothing and I'm following your investment strategy, guess what I'm going to have, right? So that's what I've done. I've just phrased it like that. You don't have to answer this question if you don't want to, but when I'm looking for somebody to manage my money, I want to see how you manage your own. Can you tell me what your net worth is outside of your home equity? My wife can attest to the fact she was sitting there. I've done it with her there twice, and the other guy I talked to myself, but I've asked three different people, three different companies, five different people this question. Three of them answered it, and two of them wouldn't. Three of them answered it, and they had no problem answering it. They're like, oh, yeah, that's a fair question. Yeah, no problem. Because a lot of people don't have a problem telling you what's in my 401k. Nobody's going to tell you what's in their bank account. That's just tacky. But to say what's in your 401k to me isn't such a big, I don't know. I just think that's different than telling somebody what you make or what's in your bank account. But anyway, they didn't have a problem with it. First guy I asked, he said, yeah, sure. He said, you know, we bought our house and we got busy and we paid it off in 2018. He's a few years older than I am. He's like 49. We paid off our house in 2018. It's worth about $600,000. And I'm thinking, okay, I'm waiting because I'm like, that's good, but I want to know. He's like, yeah, and as far as investments go, $2 million. And I'm like, all right, that's good. You're 49. You got $2.6 million in net worth. You know what you're doing, obviously. Not only do you know how to invest, you know how to live frugally. You know how to save money. You know, you're doing well. Okay, that's good. I was impressed. The next guy I was even more impressed with, $15 million. And this guy was not old. He was middle-aged. $15 million. I'm assuming he's telling the truth. He was sitting right next to his business partner, and his business partner said far less, so it would give credence to what he was saying. But he had started working, I think it was for Merrill Lynch or something, some big investment house, right out of college, making buku bucks and obviously investing all of that and doing well and wisely. And yeah, he was, yeah, $15 million. I thought, okay, well, that's good. Yeah, and his business partner said $4.1 million. And which, you know, it's funny how things are comparative. I'm thinking, 4.1, what, are you lazy or what? Because this guy's got 15. But I mean, 4.1 is a lot of money, right? I mean, obviously. And he wasn't old either. Maybe, I mean, late 40s, early 50s maybe or something. And he's like, yeah, my partner, he's a little more conservative than I am. And so, I mean, that was probably why. But anyway, I mean, that was very impressive to me. I thought, these guys know how to manage money, right? They know about investments, clearly. I didn't ask, but I'm assuming they didn't get some huge inheritance or something. You know, if I say, what's your net worth? And he says, $2 million. I say, what'd you get in inheritance? $3 million. You know, then, you know, no, I'm not going with you. But two of them wouldn't answer the question. The one guy just said that, well, I've never been asked that question before, and he just kind of diverted it and didn't want to answer it. And then the other guy said something about, well, I forget what, but basically, I don't need to be making money off your account to pay my bills or something like that. But anyway, I honestly just wasn't very impressed because I'm like, I mean, if why not tell me so that I know you know what you're doing. But I was impressed with the three. And I had pretty good confidence in them. So this is going to depend on the person's age, right? If he's young, I mean, if he's in his mid to late 20s, and he's out of college just for a few years, and he's, you know, a financial advisor, you know, does he have a net worth over $100,000? That'd be a good, you got over 100 grand, you're in your mid, late 20s, that'd be all right. If he's middle-aged, you know, maybe 40s, early 50s, something, does he have a net worth over $500,000 excluding home equity? You know, he's doing all right, I think. If he's near retirement, does he have a net worth of at least $1 million excluding home equity? You know, I think those would be rough figures to get an idea. You know, if I go to a financial advisor and he's 60 years old and I say, hey, what do you got in investments? Oh, I got $100,000 in my IRA. I'm going somewhere else. I mean, you know, you're a financial advisor. That's not impressive. Now, if he doesn't have a high net worth for his age, then he obviously is not good at managing his own money. So why would you have him manage yours? Let's look at Romans 2 and verse 21, give you a scriptural principle here. Romans 2 and verse 21. See, this is a good rule to follow. You always want to hire people that are smarter than you are. That goes, if you're a business owner, hire people that are smarter than you. Don't hire people that are dumber than you so you can feel superior to them. Hire people that are smarter than you are, especially in whatever area you're hiring them for. Hire a financial advisor that is smarter than you are, that is richer than you are, that has done better than you ever hoped to do, because then he'll probably do all right for you. Romans 2 and verse 21. Thou therefore which teachest another, teachest thou not thyself? Thou that preachest a man should not steal, dost thou steal? Thou that manages money for other people, manage your own. Right? Thou that buildest wealth for other people, build your own. You can't do it for yourself. Why do you think you're going to be able to do it for somebody else? Let me give you a good analogy, I think it's a good analogy. Imagine you have an old antique car of some kind. It's been sitting in a barn for years. It needs a full frame-off restoration. You ask around, you talk to some friends, and you find two or three men that do this kind of work. And you go and you talk to them. And you talk to the first one, and he says, oh yeah, man, that thing will look like a piece of glass when I'm done. It'll look like it just came off the showroom floor, total frame off. I mean, everything. This thing's going to be beautiful, perfect, no problem. Here, it'll only cost you X amount. You know, it'll cost you $20,000. This thing's going to be perfect. And you say, oh, well, that sounds great. Do you have any antique cars of your own that you've restored? Oh yeah, yeah, I got a 67 Camaro. I got a 55 Chevy. Sure. Well, can I take a look at them? I've never been asked that question before. Well, no, that's my personal car. You can't look at my car. I'm gonna be like, okay, I'll let you know. I'm gonna see if I can talk to somebody else. And then I go talk to somebody else. Same conversation. Yeah, I got a Camaro. I got a 55 Chevy. Did full frame off. Can I see it? Oh, absolutely. Come on in here. Look at this thing. It's just perfect, flawless, right? You're like, you can do my car because I've seen how you do your own. You know, the guy that won't show you his car, or if you happen to catch a glimpse of it and it looks like it's as wavy as an 80s hairdo or something like that, full of putty, yeah, probably not a good idea. So I don't think it's an inappropriate question at all. It took a little bit of guts, I'll say. I was going to use another word. It took a little bit of guts to ask the question, but I'm really glad that I did. And the worst thing that they can say is no, and then they might not call you back. And that's okay, too. That's okay, too. All right, another question to ask is, has he beat the S&P, the S&P 500, over the last 10 years, for instance? So ask him if you can see a 10-year or more track record of his performance and see how it compares to the S&P 500. That's a fair question to ask, I think. Ask him for a few examples of mutual funds that he recommends to his clients or that he would recommend for you in your situation. And then ask him, and then take those mutual funds, take the ticker symbols and compare them to the S&P and Google Finance, like I told you how to do, and see how they performed against it. Now, I can see if you ask, say, tell me the entire, all the funds that you're going to put in my money into, tell me every one of them, and I want to research them. And I can see him saying, well, no, because if I tell you every one of them, you can just go do it yourself, right? I can see him not divulging all that information. But to ask for one or two of them, and if he's still squeamish about it, say, I'll tell you what, here, take those funds, put them in Google Finance against the S&P and black out the fund name so I don't even know what the fund is, and let me see how it did against the S&P. You know, that would definitely be reasonable. I mean, you're going to know what funds he puts you in as soon as you start working with him, and you can leave him at any time. So, and that's another thing. When you get a financial advisor, make sure that this is not the Hotel California. You know, you can check in any time you like, but you can never leave. Make sure that you can leave at any time. It's your money, your account. His name is only on the accounts as a manager, but it's your account, and you can go any time and transfer to another dealer or to another broker or another advisor or another broker house entirely. You make sure that it's completely yours. But anyway, the point is you can leave any time, right? So if he won't tell you what the funds are now, well, you're going to see them later. And if you get in there and you start poking around, and you're like, you know what? These funds haven't even done as well as the S&P. You might leave anyway. So he would do well, I think, to tell you a little bit up front anyway of what he's going to do for you and so that you can check it out. You know what the Bible teaches? Prove all things. Hold fast that which is good. Just don't believe everything he tells you. Prove them. 1 Thessalonians 5 and verse 21. 1 Thessalonians 5:21. Prove all things, hold fast that which is good. So that's why it's a good idea to talk to a few different financial advisors, prove them out, and then you have a hard decision to make, because it's hard. If you've ever been shopping for anything and you looked at multiple options, and then you're like, oh man, I like this about this one, I like that about that one, I don't know, you know, and then it makes it a lot easier just to go to the first one and do it, but it's a stupid thing to do, right? Get some different opinions and then make the hard decision. Not easy, but it's best in the long run. Don't be stupid and just believe what he claims, but look into it to see if he's actually done what he says he can do. Proverbs 14 and verse 15. That could be it, looking at, you know, his past track record. Of course, that all can be manipulated. But you know the best way that you can see if he can actually do what he says he can do? What's your net worth? That'll tell you what he can do, if he'll answer that one, if he's telling you the truth. Proverbs 14:15. The simple believeth every word, but the prudent man looketh well to his going. So don't just believe everything they say. Check it out. Now, the one place that I talked to, they did all this work ahead of time. They had it. They entered all the information that I gave them, all the numbers, and they had it, a whole system where you could see at this age, here's what your account balance will be worth if it's growing at this percentage rate, and they could factor in Social Security or not factor in Social Security, just at the click of a button. I mean, all that stuff, and with how much you're contributing every month and yada, yada. And the great thing is about that system is at the end of the first year, you can just log in there and see, okay, they said I should have this much. How much do I have? You know, end of the second year, I should have this much. How much do I have? And, you know, you can, I mean, it's measurable. And then now if the stock market's been down, obviously that's one thing. So you take your account balance and then compare it to what the S&P's done and see, okay, even though maybe I'm down 10% this year, was the S&P, what was it down? If it was down 8 or 10%, you know, okay. If it was down 2% and I'm down 10, there's a problem, right? So anyway, it's good to find one like that that has like a very demonstrable way of showing you where you're going and of measuring to see if you're getting there or not. Now, as I said, I think it was last Sunday, if you don't know much about finance or investing, talk to somebody that you know who does and ask his opinion on the financial advisor and his recommendations. Right? It's always a good idea, because if you don't know much, anybody that knows more than you can bamboozle you very easily. Right? Like the example of going to the mechanic if you don't know anything about cars. The mechanic could tell you anything is wrong with that car, and you'd have no way of verifying it. Even if he showed you a picture of it, you wouldn't even know what you're looking at. Some of these mechanics today, they actually, it's pretty neat. They go in there and they inspect the car of whatever it needs. They'll take pictures of everything and they'll show it to you. You get a website link and you go and you can see the pictures. But if you don't know what you're looking at, you're just looking at a picture of something. You're like, okay, I guess it needs replaced. You don't know, right? So just like that in this situation, you talk to some financial advisors. Talk to somebody that you know. And say, hey, here's what he told me, and get that person's opinion. Now, if you go and say, and that person you talk to, your friend that knows something about this, and he says, so what did the financial advisor tell you? Something about just buy this or that and it'll be fine. Okay, you know, go to another financial advisor. Right? If you can't explain it, don't do it, right? All right, so I told you we were going to get to budgeting. And I lied. So we will get to budgeting next week, Lord willing, if the Lord doesn't come back yet and if I manage to live that long. So I thank you for your kind and patient attention again.